Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This is Michelle Carville, author of Myths of Social Media, Dismiss the Misconceptions and Use Social Media Effectively in Business. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I produce this podcast to help us both keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow faster by taking a sales-based approach to marketing. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. And if you're one of the many, many listeners who's left a review on Apple Podcasts, I want to drop a little something in the mail to thank you. Details after the interview. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Michelle Carville to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the book she has co-authored with Ian McCrae, Myths of Social Media, Dismiss the Misconceptions and Use Social Media Effectively in Business, published by Kogan Page. Michelle Carville founded the social media marketing agency Carville Creative in 2002. Its clients include the BBC, Nuffield Health, and Norbord. She is also the author of Get Social, Social Media Strategy and Tactics for Leaders. Michelle is a regular contributor to BBC Radio, the Institute of Directors, the Charter Institute of Marketing, and numerous magazines and trade journals as an expert in the field of social media and digital. And this year, Michelle was cited by Thinkers 360 as one of the top 100 B2B marketers to follow. Michelle, congratulations on the Myths of Social Media and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Wonderful to be here.
So your book is part of the Myths series from Kogan Page, and I love the idea. And I'm going to be interviewing another author about his Myths book soon, Grant Leboff, who's written Myths of Marketing, Banish the Misconceptions and Become a Great Marketer. And I believe you said you know him.
I do. Yeah, I do. We've spoken at similar events over the past years.
Great to have another author from the UK, especially since there are so many Marketing Book Podcast listeners in the UK that I hear from. So I want to read something from the back of the book that I found amusing. Everyone knows that social media is free. Millennials are all adept social media experts. Businesses always have to be available 24/7. And ultimately, none of it really matters as the digital space is full of fake news and online messaging is seen as inauthentic. And those are just a few of the myths. You've got 28 chapters where you cover even more myths than that. But I was hoping to go through maybe a half dozen or so that I see businesses struggle with all the time. That be all right?
That sounds great. Perfect.
Okay. Well, before we get started, I wanted to ask about something that you write about on page 11. You write that to this day, there is still confusion surrounding the role of social media within many boardrooms. Why do you think that still is?
I think, you know, it's interesting because they're not new technologies now, and they're very stress tested in many ways, in many uses. But I do think that it kind of, it's a bit of a legacy issue that these social networks came about. And at the time, they were largely around, they were taken on by people and individuals to connect with their friends. So, you know, Twitter was about, what are you doing? And people were really utilizing them to just connect personally. They weren't business tools. They were appropriated initially for connection. And then later on, businesses started to open up their eyes to the opportunities, particularly marketeers like me started to look at these channels and think, hey, you know, they open up opportunity to actually be listening and learning from our audiences directly. And at the board level, these weren't enterprise technologies. These weren't expensive CRM suites or, you know, resources that they had to invest in. This was something that was just happening from the kind of ground up, from the front line and the ground up. So the decisions weren't the same. You know, you didn't, these were resources that were free. So I think that there's a bit of a legacy that they weren't seen as important tools. I think they were just seen as distractions and, people posting things about their breakfast and a load of nonsense going on these channels. And really people weren't thinking about them strategically. And I think there's still a lot of skepticism for some people who still don't get that. That's why I wrote Get Social. I know we're not talking about that, but that was exactly why I wrote Get Social, because I'd spoken with so many teams who said, look, we get this. We understand the power of social technologies, but we're not getting the budgets and the buy-ins to do what we want to do from the boardroom because they don't get it. They're not thinking about these tools strategically. It's not part of their toolbox. And so, you know, it's kind of like keep banging your head against a brick wall. And I think it's shifting. And I think, of course, we are in the throes of this pandemic. And I think that transformation of those that were even very skeptical about social technologies are now seeing how useful they've been in connecting people with their employees and indeed with their customers.
I had to laugh at one point in the book where you were talking about how these days there are fewer and fewer companies that are just throwing the social media to the intern. I think they've all or more have started to see how that is very often a bad idea that can sometimes blow up in their face. And there's no shortage of case studies out there that explain that. But I'm wondering, what is it that does get someone at the board or management level to start looking into using social media or taking it more seriously? And I was wondering, do you think it's more often than not that their competition is starting to do it that gets them on board?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that often it's the listening piece, Douglas. You know, it's when they can see, when you show them the insights of what is going on, yes, with their competitors, the conversations that are going on around their brand, the conversations that, you know, people are having separately, you know, about their brand and their product and their services without them even, you know, being part of the conversation. When you show them the insights of what is actually happening and what they can tap into, I think that's when it becomes quite interesting. And then it's how you can utilize those insights for good. I mean, I famously, I didn't famously interview John Legere of T-Mobile, but I did forget in Get Social because he's a very social CEO. And I thought, well, I don't want to persuade leaders, you know, with my facts and stats and research. I'd rather them hear from people, leaders who are doing this firsthand and are gaining some incredible insights by doing so. So I interviewed a number of leaders and said, you know, well, what do you get out of this? You know, what was it that kind of, you know, made you stop, think, open your eyes to the benefits and opportunities that social media provides? And without exception, every single one of them said it is to do with the listening piece and the listening in. And that's John Legere famously said, you know, he was just tapping into what people were saying about his competitors and what they weren't enjoying about what the competitors were doing, where those where people were failing and saying, well, actually, we could resolve this. You know, we could change things. We can make a difference. And of course, it starts to support and inform business decisions and product strategy. And, you know, that insights can be hugely valuable. So yeah, it's not always statistically correct, but it gives you enough of a steer as to what is going on in the marketplace. And I think that can really shift people when they start to see the insights that can be gleaned.
Interesting. You know, that reminds me of more back in my days as an ad man, where I was working on more consumer brands and things like that. I can remember doing man on the street interviews where we would just stop people and we had a camera and we would just ask them questions about various brands, and we would include our clients' brands in there and part of the discussion. But you know, I never saw clients more quiet than when we would show these interviews to them, and they would sit there in silence listening to these unvarnished comments from various consumers. It was really fascinating. One other thing I want to ask you about the book before we get into some of the specific myths is, how did you go about assembling these 28 chapters? I mean, my hunch is that there might have been even more than that. And what about the order of them?
Well, there were a lot more, and it was really a case of, you know, storyboarding it, getting it all down, looking at the myths, mainly from as you said at the beginning, you know, the questions that I'd been asked so many times around certain misconceptions. And so we thought, well, you know, there are some obvious ones. There are some that, you know, I really didn't think, you know, seriously, we're going to have to talk about social media is free, you know, is that still a myth? But for some audiences, 100% it is, you know. And so we kind of threw it all up into the air, and then we whittled it down as to which ones we felt were the most relevant and which ones we felt we could write about with, you know, that would be useful and interesting for people. And then as to the order, we weren't, you know, there wasn't really any kind of science behind how we formulated that. It just seemed to kind of organically roll into place around some of the, you know, the waste of time, it's free, they all do the same thing. So there were some that were more focused on, I suppose, the channels and the practicalities and the measurement side of the actual channels. And then we moved into the kind of implementation, more about broadcasting and in-house and how it balances with real world networking, and your business has to be available all the time. And then we moved into more of the kind of, I say, probably more recent issues around fake news and trade secrets and information bubbles and influencers, you know. So it kind of had a natural journey, and then we brought it all together with a little bit about data and digital footprints, making it a little bit more personalized towards the end. So we didn't really set out to do that, but it just organically went that way. And of course, I was writing with Ian, so we were splitting things up and saying, okay, well, you write this bit, I'll write that bit, and oh, that fits nicely there. So, you know, the whole post-it notes on the wall, and you know, we just moved things around and decided that we liked the flow of it, and it seems to work really well.
So myth number one is social media is a waste of time. And we're not actually going to talk about that one, but I can see why you had to put that one first, because I can just imagine someone may not be saying that, but they're sitting there at the boardroom with their arms crossed thinking, this is something my grandchildren do, or this is something the kids are doing. But I wanted to touch on one that you mentioned there, which was number two, social media is free. And it brought to mind something I once heard Jay Baer say several years ago, where he explained, yeah, social media is free, kind of like a puppy is free.
Yes.
So remind listeners why social media is in fact not free. You started to touch on it earlier, where it's not like you're buying an enterprise level piece of software that makes everyone take it seriously, but it's definitely not free.
Absolutely not. And I think, you know, if you think about every social media activity, every social media engagement, every social media post, you know, everything that you're doing with social media is effectively a brand touch point. And when you think about it that way, these channels are potentially the most far-reaching channels that you can have. You can reach thousands, if not millions of people, if you know what you're doing effectively, and if you've got budgets to optimize the paid and take advantage of all of those aspects. So you can really exploit the reach. You can really reach the relevant audiences. You can target people very specifically. And to do that well, and to do it so that it is a great representation of your brand, and it is a great use of time for your organization, then it is anything but free, because you really need people who know what they're doing. So those people, you're paying them a salary, you're paying for that expertise, you're paying for paid activity throughout these channels to support your organic activity, you're paying for the expertise often to learn about how to optimize these social media channels, and training, provisions, consulting, people that are coming in to support your team. You'll be paying for the content that is required, because if you think about social media, the media is really the heart and soul of what it is that you are then socializing. You know, you're putting out content so that, and your story and your narrative, so that you can engage, excite, entertain, and get people to know you, like you, and trust you. So that's one aspect. So all of that is quite a significant investment when you think about it from a people, content, development, creativity, brand story, brand narrative, and keeping that going 24/7. Because the thing about social media, it's a continuous conversation. You kind of in it, you don't jump out of it. It's not like a campaign that runs for 6 weeks and then you stop. You may have campaigns running within your activity for 6 weeks that then change and dynamic, but actually you're always on. So it's a significant investment of time and, of course, of resource to keep that going. And then from the other side of it, the other side of the conversation, the one side is the showcasing, this is who we are, so people can know me, like me, trust me. The other side is tuning in to what your audience is saying. And those listening resources, there are some resources that you can use that are free. You can use very basic resources like Google Alerts or searches on the native platforms themselves and track what people are saying. But there are some very sophisticated social listening resources that will give you insights, that will give you incredible intelligence, business intelligence that can be utilized to really move that business, product, service forward. And so all of those investments into it, if you're doing it well, it is far from free.
So the platform may be free, but that's about the only free thing.
That's about the only free thing.
The expression I often hear is that when something is free, it's because you are the product. So most of these platforms are going to stay, quote, free because they want more users and engagement. And could you explain more about that when you say that you are both the customer and the product? So they're free because they want you and your information.
Absolutely, they do. And so you are utilizing these channels for your benefit. You're utilizing them to get people to know you, like you, trust you, to be doing the social listening, to glean insights as to what's going on in your landscape, so that you can sell more, be more, develop more. And of course, it's a kind of partnership, because you're utilizing this channel, but they're utilizing you, because the content that you are putting through there and the engagement that you are driving, the platforms are learning about that. And so for you to want to do a better job at targeting, you're kind of fueling their insights, so that when you're then spending money to target better, it's the activity that we've all been doing that is driving their knowledge to be able to optimize that and sell it back to us as targeting, so we can become even more efficient with the way that we market and reach our audiences. So it's a kind of two-way partnership. You know, I've over the years, I've heard a lot of pushback and a lot of people moaning and groaning about, oh, you know, Facebook and Instagram, they take all of our data and we don't know what they're doing with it. But it's kind of, you know, my retort is always the same. Well, nobody's forcing you to go onto those channels. Nobody's forcing you to be utilizing the Facebook ads platform or, you know, sharing your content and growing audiences on Instagram. Nobody's forcing you to do that. That's your choice. And when you go into, you go into this with your eyes wide open that, of course, they're going to be gleaning data so that they can optimize, because that's their business model. You know, I don't think that anybody's not been transparent about that since the get-go.
I agree. And I find that tiresome when people complain about these free social media platforms. But you know, there was another line in your book that I really liked, and it was helpful to be reminded of. And that is that these social media platforms, they are advertising platforms. You know, social media, they are advertising platforms, which may be why I'm spending less and less time on social media, because I'm seeing so many ads. But moving on, this next myth is one that evidently a lot of people think, and maybe it's because it's chapter four, and it could be done a lot by smaller businesses, but I also see it done by bigger ones, and that is that social media can replace your business websites. And the reason I say them is also a problem with bigger companies is because, yes, they have websites, but they're spending a disproportionate amount of time and effort in the social media when I would often recommend get your website squared away first. And there's also another great line at the end of this chapter, which is be cautious about putting all your eggs in one basket, especially if it's someone else's basket.
Yeah. I mean, that I think that they do provide such a great opportunity, particularly, I've spoken to a lot of business owners who have developed their businesses purely on social media platforms. You know, they've created communities through Facebook groups, and from that they've, you know, surprised themselves by generating serious amounts of revenue by monetizing these communities and doing things that way. And they've never had a website. You know, it's just been purely through some of the social networks. And I think there's a really positive aspect there, that for a startup who is struggling and they don't have the investment and they don't have the knowledge and even some of these kind of out of the box website packages, you know, for some people that's just too much of a stretch. They may not be tech savvy that way, but they are very comfortable with, say, Facebook, and they're very comfortable creating a Facebook page and a group. So I see it as a very positive, as a way of enabling business to get started. But then I think it comes to a point, like with any organization, where you then have to start making some choices about, hang on a minute, safeguarding and what it is that you've got. And yes, the channels can be great. They should be supplementary to your website, ideally, because if you're a large organization, a large brand, you're going to have your website. It still adds a huge amount of credibility. People will always come back and check out your website. So, you know, you need to keep that up to date. But if you've started with your Facebook page or you're just on social media, then the warning sign is once things start to get moving in that way, it's a great place to kind of stress test, isn't it? You know, you could test whether or not there's an appetite and set up a group and do things. But as soon as things start to motor and become substantial, then it's time to kind of support that in it, as I suppose, you know, many years ago we would say, you know, you have to get the desk space or open up the shop and get people to come in. So your website is really your kind of online bricks and mortar, and you do need to safeguard that. I do think that, because should Facebook change all the game, should Instagram and Twitter, you know, everything shift and you've got your, you know, all your eggs in that basket, then that's a risky proposition if if your business is balanced on somebody else's proposition. So yeah, it's just really sensible, removing the risk from your business in any way, shape that you can. Get a website, make sure that you're collecting data on your website so it's not all dependent on Facebook, and that you are driving those social audiences back to your website so that that data is yours rather than somebody else's.
That is such an important concept for businesses to understand. And when you mentioned that there are some companies that have grown and gotten started and done well on social media, perhaps without a website, I often want to say, yeah, and occasionally somebody wins the lottery.
Yeah.
So you talk in the book about the many advantages of businesses moving customers from the social media to their owned channels. And there's another great line in the book, one that I'm stealing, Michelle Carville, with full attribution. And you say, social media is a shop window. Social media is a shop window. I'm stealing that. I'm stealing it with full attribution.
You can have that.
Thank you. Now, let's go to another one, which is chapter 10. Social media is purely for broadcasting. Let me read this. Far from being socially engaged with audiences, it is very clear that the whole purpose of many accounts is purely to broadcast. In fact, the focus on broadcasting overrides any opportunity for genuine engagement. So much so that comments, shares, retweets, or other signals of engagement are often totally ignored. Clearly, no one is tasked with monitoring and primed to respond. The two-way conversational aspect of being social just isn't part of the remit. So I have an idea, Michelle, and I just want to throw this out there because I don't often have ideas, and that is that once a month, companies only post on social media things that have question marks at the end. And then, so basically only ask questions one day a month to your audiences, and then go back and look at your analytics and see if there's actually a lot more engagement with them. So talk about this broadcasting thing. This is also, is this part of that legacy, this muscle memory that people have where, you know, marketers get hold of it and start treating it like everything else they were doing and using it as simply a shouting channel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they still do. You know, they absolutely still do. You know, I'm working with unpicking some problems with a client, you know, just this week and, you know, dealing with their marketing team. And it is, you know, it's all broadcast. And, you know, it is what marketers do with channels. You know, it's what we do. It's what we were trained to do, to take these channels and optimize them and tell our stories and promote. You were in advertising. I started in advertising. You know, that's kind of what it was all about. And,
oh, we should start a support group.
We should. But, you know, for me, I suppose when I first, as a marketeer, maybe I was unusual, I don't think so, but I remember thinking that these social media channels, wow, this is going to be really interesting because brands and organizations for years have been talking about, oh, we really want to get to know the customer. We really want to know the customer. The customer is king, queen, you know, it's everything to us. It's the heart of our business. And the more we can do to get to know them, the better. And you know, we've heard that for years and years and years from organizations and from a marketing perspective, the marketing mantra, customer, get to know the customer. But here were tools when I first saw them and I thought, well, this is marketing nirvana because here are tools that allow us to really get to know the customer and to really allow the customer to talk back to us and tell us what they think about us. And, you know, I suspect that whilst organizations say they want to hear this stuff, we all know that they don't. And the enlightened ones, as we've seen now, engage with their audiences. You know, they've started to learn the importance of having genuine conversations because it's kind of, as we said earlier, it's like having co-creation opportunities. It's like having focus group opportunities. It's like listening in and, oh my goodness, they're just telling us what we need to do. Maybe we should listen and just just do what they're telling us we need to do. So I think that we're not conditioned as marketeers, or we weren't conditioned as marketeers, to listen. We pretended to with market research and focus groups, you know, and we would do that periodically, but we're certainly not conditioned, or haven't been conditioned, to be listening all of the time and having genuine, authentic, engaged conversations, and to be more interested in what our customers are saying than interested in what we feel we've got to say. You know, it's always been about, oh, share the brand story. And that has shifted. And if you think about any conversation, I know I'm doing quite a bit of talking now, but that's the focus of the podcast interview is. But in most conversations, to be very connected, you do more listening, and you're kind of really listening to what the other person says, and then they're listening to what you say. And we all know those people that, you know, they're not listening. You know that this is just all about them. They're not really that bothered about what you've got to say, because they're all about themselves and they just want to broadcast. And we all know how we feel about those people. And that's exactly, if we allow ourselves to think about that same kind of analogy and apply it to business and social media, it's the same things. We're all done to death with the, we know what you sell, we know what you do, we know you're very successful, we know this, we know that, we know some of the problems that you solve. That's great. But what about me, the consumer? You know, what are you doing for me? How are you solving my problems? How are you talking to me? How are you connecting with me? And, you know, it's playing out that those organizations that are really interested in their audiences, they're the ones that will win through. And that's really what it comes to with broadcasting. Be less about you and be more about what you do for them. It's kind of marketing 101, but with social media, you get to play it out, and you don't get to do that in many other channels. And, you know, I'm still surprised, almost 20 years done with social media channels, that it is still, you know, you just still see broadcast. Take the broadcast campaign that we're doing offline or TV or out of house, and let's just push it into social media. You know, no, it doesn't work. It's not a conversation. We wrote the book, we wrote the chapter, and we still see lots of people doing it day in, day out. So, you know, it's not changed. It's changed, but it's not changed enough.
And yet that is one of the secrets to success, being able to listen to and understand your customers just a little bit better than the competition. So, Michelle, let's not talk about you. Let's talk about me for just a minute. Occasionally I get invited to give presentations about, you know, some key ideas I've learned from maybe 300 books. And one of the most important things that I've learned that keeps coming up in so many books is that the most successful companies are the ones with the deepest insights and understanding of their customers. Those are the ones that always win in the end.
Yep. Always.
So let me just quote from page 81 here. It says, "The myth that social media is purely for broadcasting your organization's messages is not true. The bulk of activity should ideally focus where the gold lies, and that's in the listening." So let's go on to the next one, and it's particularly relevant to people in sales and even more so in this pandemic era, and that is that social media replaces real life networking. And I want to quote from the subtitle. It says, "Social networking certainly doesn't replace face-to-face networking, but rather plays both a lead role and a supportive role, helping you to start and deepen relationships." Can you explain more about what's meant by the leading and the supportive role? Because I see a lot of people wasting a lot of time on social media thinking that they're networking, and it's really not a replacement.
Yeah. So I suppose, you know, if you think about your first impression, first impressions counting, because they do, you know, most people's first connection, first impression will now be a digital one. So, you know, if I haven't met you, you haven't met me, but you've looked at my profile, I've looked at your profile, we've learned a little bit about one another. And, you know, that isn't unusual nowadays. You know, most people are connecting digitally and then potentially meeting offline, you know, deepening those relationships and meeting offline and doing, you know, business or whatever. And then of course, you know, spin that round the other way. If people meet offline, the first thing they do is then connect digitally so that they can stay connected and deepen that relationship further, you know, and be useful and supportive of one another. So, when we think about our networks now, I mean, I have built networks with people around specific topics that I'm talking around, particularly around digital and leadership. And that will, those people, some of them I've never met at all. Yet I feel that I've built a support group that I can go back to with particular questions, you know, if I needed support. It feels like I know these people, even though we've never physically met. And I think that, you know, the recent pandemic has proven to everybody that you can be very connected digitally and still be very supportive of one another. And more of us have done that over this time. So our networks, whether they are, you know, it's not about replacing, it's about they support. Because if you've met somebody offline and you're building that network, it's very difficult to, you know, we're all busy. We may not have the time to be going to an event once a week, once a month, but we certainly have time to be following somebody on LinkedIn and, you know, connecting or commenting on something that they say or get brought into a Twitter conversation because, you know, Michelle, what do you think about this? And again, it's a group of kind of like-minded people having a conversation. So from a time perspective and a convenience perspective, it's a great way of constantly staying in touch with people who matter. And that isn't necessarily just from a kind of selling perspective. That's just from a supportive perspective. From a sales perspective and from that networking perspective, often a lot of people will build out their network so that, you know, so that they are looking to do business with one another, or can you put me in touch with somebody who we can do business with? And what social enables you to do in that is to kind of consistently grow your share of mind and grow your authority in a way that is meaningful and purposeful. So if you're sharing your content and you're very passionate about what it is you do and you're an authority on a subject, or you've just got some really interesting views, or you don't agree and you've got, you know, a really interesting counter argument to something, it starts to draw people to you by the content that you are sharing. So it isn't, you know, it isn't these the things that happen on LinkedIn where people will say, oh, I see you've got so many people that we're connected to, let's connect. There's just no substance there. And I think people don't play the networking aspect correctly or as effectively as they could do. Because if, again, they were just listening in and tuning into the conversations and genuinely interested in building out a network for a purpose and thinking about how can I very quickly get to people who are useful for me, interesting to me, and that I'm actually going to really enjoy being part of a network with, that's a very different proposition than just trying to spam everybody with network connections. So I think you approach it as you would in the offline world. You think about, you know, if you went to an event, you wouldn't be thinking, okay, there's 500 people in this room. Who do I speak to? You know, are they all like me? Or, you know, you'd be trying to find the people that you really genuinely want to connect with. And so you'd be asking questions, you'd be listening, you'd be getting involved in conversations. Some of them may be useful, some of them aren't. And then you'd move on and think, well, that's not really not my audience. You know, they're not really part of the network that I want to be part of. So I think that we can apply real world thinking and tactics to what we do online to make our online networking more purposeful.
Michelle, I couldn't agree with you more. And honestly, I think we've both been taking a lot of the same crazy pills. And this even takes me back to the thing we were talking about, where about broadcasting. The people I get a lot of these LinkedIn connections from, they clearly didn't even look at the profile, my profile, to say anything relevant.
Yes.
Imagine my excitement when occasionally I do get a LinkedIn connection from somebody that says, hey, I listened to your podcast. I want to ask you about a book or something like that. It's great.
Yeah. And I get it. You know, I get that the tools are useful for that because you can see people's profiles. But, you know, as you say, people don't often even look at your profile. I mean, I've been asked, you know, do you want some social media training? Do you want some, you know, help with your marketing? And it's kind of like, oh, well, you're either being really rude or you haven't even looked at my profile before you're pitching me with this, you know, with this irrelevant message. And, you know, going back to the basis of the question around which leads which, it's likely nowadays that most of your connections will come online, and then you can really develop some meaningful networks. I've developed some such useful kind of round table networks that with incredible people that I find, you know, this conversation is stimulating. We've been useful to one another, and I feel very supported and very privileged to have these people in my connection and feel that I can just tap into them. And that hasn't been because I just, you know, sent them some strange message and said, hey, let's connect. And they thought, yeah, let's do it. It's because we've all genuinely come together around a common purpose, a common thread. It's a network that actually means something. And we have that opportunity to do that digitally to support then what you need to do offline, you know, and develop those relationships even further.
That's funny that they were offering social media training to you. It's like I've actually gotten messages asking if I would like English language lessons, which, hey, maybe I do.
Yeah, thanks.
It was probably a listener, you know. And hey, you know, I take all criticism and praise. Keep it coming. If I need some English language lessons, occasionally I do. I'll work on that. And speaking of criticism, let's talk about chapter 15, which is, it's not worth responding to criticism on social media. Now, keep in mind, listener, that's a myth. And yes, I've actually heard those words from new clients in the past, but it brought to mind yet another one of the many books that's been on the show, even entire books about that topic, which was called Hug Your Haters by Jay Baer. I seem to be mentioning him a lot here today. But it's worth responding, and it's really beneficial to respond to criticism. And it's related to that issue of listening to people. You write, it can take a bit of work to sort the troublemakers from legitimate complaints, but responding to complaints and criticism on social media is well worth the effort when it is done well.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks volumes, doesn't it, about a person and about a brand. It shows that you're listening to the complaints. And often, you know, I actually studied complaining behavior. It was kind of a big part of my thesis back in, in the 90s when I was at business school. And people who complain, genuinely, the majority of people who complain, I'm not talking about trolls who are just, you know, having a go because it's easy, but people who are genuinely, you know, have got an issue with something or they're complaining about a service or the way that they were dealt with, those people are often your biggest advocates. They are complaining because they care. Because they absolutely care and they want to make a difference. I mean, I actually am a little bit of a self-confessed serial complainer. And it's not because, you know, I'm a grouch. It's because I can see that, you know, God, you could have handled that so differently. I'm a problem solver.
You're trying to help.
I'm trying to help and I'm trying to support. So, you know, when you listen in, there again, there can be some gold. Yes, there can be some nonsense. And as we mentioned in the book, you've got to sort the wheat from the chaff and figure out which ones. But going back to people and responding and going deeper if you need to, you know, so let's take this offline and let's really get to the heart of the problem here and let's figure out how we can be helping or what was the issue is really important. So, you know, that's one tactic because you want to learn and actually some of your consumers are super smart, highly educated and may have a solution for you that you just haven't thought about and could be a really quick and simple fix that could fix things for a lot of other people. So that co-creation of solutions is just as we, you know, you can listen to your employees, you can listen to your customers, you can listen to your competitors. There can be some really interesting insights. So that's an important part of the complaining process. The other aspect, of course, is that if they are complaining and you don't agree with what they're saying and you've got good reason not to agree with, you know, maybe they're saying something contentious or something disparaging about other people or disparaging about the person who works for you, you know, or and actually what they're saying isn't fair, you can actually stand your ground as the brand, as the organization, and say, you know what, well, that's a really interesting perspective. But let's set the record straight here about the facts. And you can actually, you know, rather, I mean, I love the, I think there was the whole Campbell's soup, wasn't it, with about the two dads campaign where there was somebody came back and said, I'm never buying your soup because you're supporting, you've got this campaign about two dads and we think that's terrible. And, you know, and they were complaining and they were, you know, going crazy on the social channels. And not only did the brand come back and say, actually, you know, we are standing by and here's the reason why and here are the facts. And quite frankly, if you're never going to buy our soup again, that's okay with us because, you know, we're comfortable with the type of brand that we are. We're comfortable with this stance and we can't change your mind. We don't want to change your mind. You know, we're happy with our proposition. And, but of course, all of the support that then came back from the other people on the social channels to say, we are 100% behind you, Campbell's Soup. Amazing, you know, amazing that you didn't just cow down, that you actually stood for what you stand for, and we respect that and we value that and we love you even more for that. So it can, you know, it can be a significant shift. It can be a significant brand statement, and it can be some really interesting learning. And of course, you know, it can be trolls and it can be nonsense, and you can take that offline and you can try and deal with that the best way that you can deal with it. But I think if you're not looking at it and you just think, oh, it's just complaints, just move on, you know, don't say anything, don't go back to them, it can really escalate. I mean, we've seen how some of these escalate into whole campaigns. So, you know, it's always worth capturing it, taking it seriously, figuring out where does this sit? You know, does this sit in, we need to go back to these people, we need to take this offline, we need to go back to these people and just try and pacify them, we need to actually have a conversation, or we need to make a stand here. And, you know, so what's our position here and how are we going to do this? And so that, you know, it's important. It's really important to be looking at what people are saying about you. And some of it will be nonsense, but some of it can be transitional.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of years ago, a new client at an industrial company, they had a lot of trucks and they got a complaint on social media about one of the trucks was blocking somebody or traffic or something like that. And this person complained about it on social media. And I brought it to the CEO and I said, you know, you need to respond and we can do it for you. We just need to know what to say. And I remember he said, oh, we don't need to respond. We've got her email address. We'll email her today. And I was like, no, that's, you've got to show that you're responsive and that you're taking it seriously. And he was like, oh, really? I said, yeah. And he did everything and everything turned out fine. But it was a good example of where somebody didn't quite understand that. And that also brings to mind how loyal I become to a company where I've maybe had a problem with them, and they fixed it. And after that, I don't ever want to go anywhere else because I've seen how they've been able to solve a problem, and I'm then confident that they're going to be able to work through these things with them. And years ago, I had a client, a big IT firm client, and I remember talking to the president of it one day, and he said that, you know, they, in the course of their sales and their marketing, they get asked about references and testimonials, that sort of thing. And he happened to mention that when they were talking to a new, to a prospective customer, and the issue of references came up, he would always say something like, you know, I can give you a list of happy customers, but anybody can do that. What about if I give you a list of customers where we had a problem and then we worked through it together? And it worked really, really well. And as you can imagine, that was just one aspect of why they were so enormously trusted and successful. So, but moving on to another myth, and I've seen it to a certain extent, I'm sure you've seen it a whole lot, and that is the myth that younger digital natives are all social media experts. What kind of problems have you seen companies run into when they assume that only the younger people are the digital natives and that maybe people of a certain generation just aren't going to be able to understand or do what's needed to be done?
Yeah, well, I think it's it's the practicalities really of, and I mean, it's interesting because a lot of when I was doing quite a lot of training a few years back, often it was these young interns would turn up we've been told we have to do the social media. I'm like, okay, are you a marketeer? No. Business experience? No. So it was a case of, okay, so they know the channels. They know the channels, and they're really good at using the channels, just like my teenage children are, for creating great videos, keeping in touch with their friends, and would I let them loose with my client accounts? No way, because they are using the tools in a very different way. They know the nuances of the tools. They know how to use all the fantastic stickies and great creative little aspects of the tools, but they don't understand marketing, and they don't understand business, and they don't understand risk, and they don't understand brand, and they don't understand reputation. And they don't understand strategy and being objectively driven and saying the wrong thing and not responding and making typos and, not text language and things like that. So, I mean, it is changing. It is changing because, schools now take it all very seriously. So there are modules in schools about, how to safeguard your footprint and various things like that. But again, it comes back to that point that we make these assumptions that just because you know how to use the tools, you know how to optimize these tools for business, for marketing. And again, these tools are potentially the most far-reaching, I'd say, important marketing and conversational and communication tools that we've ever seen for the last 40, 50 years. They're game changers. The way that we can communicate with anybody around the world, that they can talk back to us, that we can listen to what's going on. I mean, if you think about all of the things that the social media technologies enable, it would have blown your mind. What, we can talk to people? We can just listen in real time to what's going on, to thousands of people. Seriously, what? And they segment their conversations by hashtags. What, we can just drop into those hashtags and see a whole, yep, you can cut it, dice it, split it, target it. It's mind-blowing, really. And they are way too important to be put into the hands of people that don't get marketing strategy, that don't get business, that don't get risk, that don't get brand reputation. You can teach digital natives all of that, but don't just assume that because they know what the channels do, that they know how to use them for business. They've been using them personally to keep in touch with their friends, maybe do some videos, or do whatever they're doing personally. Business is a very different ballgame.
Yes, and I believe in David Meerman Scott's seventh edition of The New Rules of Marketing and PR, I recently interviewed him about that. He talked about American Airlines, and they have an enormous social media department. And he talked about how you, as an employee, can't work there unless you've worked for the airline for a number of years. And the reason why is because the people on social media need to understand how the airline works and what the customers are going through. And they are able to really sort of weaponize their social media to better run the company because they get so much real-time data. But again, you are not allowed in that department unless you really understand that industry and how that airline works. The last thing I wanted to ask you about from the book is the myth that social media is just exclusively for talking to customers. And I've spoken in recent years to a number of companies and CEOs, and right now, well, at least before the pandemic started, so many companies talked about how their bigger challenge than getting more customers was getting the right kind of employees and recruiting. You know, there's the talent war out there. And so you talk about how social media can be used for that very purpose. And seemed like this might also be a great way for marketers to promote the idea of doing more social media, not necessarily for getting more customers, but by helping with recruitment. And maybe it's something that the HR department would do rather than just the marketing folks. So could you talk a bit about how savvy companies are using social media now and how that's working out?
Well, I think, you know, it comes back to brand and employer brand and being able to, just in the same way that we talked about getting people to know you, like you, and trust you from a consumer perspective, it's also your employees and, you know, internal social media and utilizing social media to connect your employees, to enable those employees to become their own thought leaders, you know, to support them with social technologies so that they can be sharing content out and giving them opportunities, which they then share out and tell their friends about, that people see what's going on. It really all just starts to build the employer brand. And that it's not something you can hide away from because it's very visible. So people can see and you know, they can see, well, what's going on within this organization? How does this organization operate? Look at all of the employees within this organization. They all seem to be very happy and advocates of what's going on. It allows that transparency from the inside out so people can learn more about that organization. It also, in the same way, allows you to target and find relevant talent to run some, you know, to find the right type of people that you're looking for by doing the listening. And so, there are many benefits to be used to not only just nurturing and connecting with your own employees so that they become your ambassadors and they're your advocates and they drive interest for new people wanting to come into your business for new talent, because that's the best way of recruiting, is through people within your business bringing other people into your business. And if they are sharing on their social networks what's going on in their organization, the new project that they've just been given to work on, or they are being encouraged to blog or create content, you know, that they then spread out to their networks, these people see them and say, I want to work for that organization. So the talent pool can become very aligned, and it can become, it's very transparent for people to see what's going on within that organization. So again, they have that two-pronged approach, what it is that they're sharing organically and what it is that they're doing to target those individuals that they want to come into the business.
Quoting from page 172, we could write an entire chapter on attracting employees through social media, or even a whole book on communicating brand identity through social media platforms. However, it's not that complicated. People want to work for companies they like. People want to work for companies that provide good pay, perks, and benefits. People want to feel good about what the company they work for does. And actually, this talks to another myth. I think it was number 6 in the book. We didn't have time to go over, but social media shouldn't be restricted just to marketing. Here's an example of something that human resources folks, for instance, could be doing. So, Michelle, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I would hope that it is that social media is significantly important to the strategic direction and growth of a brand and an organization. It's complex and it should be embraced strategically. Don't leave it to chance.
Such great advice. Michelle, what's one thing a listener could do today to put in practice one of the many ideas from the book?
I think they could do that thing that you said, you know, stop broadcasting and start engaging in a more conversational way. And that definitely means listening more than speaking. You know, I love the two eyes, two ears, just the one mouth. On social media, use it in that balance.
Absolutely. So, Michelle, looking back, what books have had the most impact on your career?
Oh, you know, I am a crazy book reader.
Well, you found your podcast, Michelle.
Yeah, I did. I have.
You're with your people.
I have. I'm my people. So I've wall to wall in books, and I've always read books. And I suppose the book that inspired my work and career, I have to go back to like 2000. It's a book I still dip into. I think it was way ahead of its time, and they were definitely speaking to me in this book. And it's The Clue Train Manifesto. An amazing book, The End of Business as Usual. I read it then. You could read it now. They just knew what was coming. And I remember reading it and thinking, this, you know, this is such a great book.
And The Clue Train Manifesto has been mentioned by several other authors that have been guests on the show.
Really? Excellent.
And several have talked about how prescient it was. You could read it now and it would still be just as relevant.
Oh, you can. Yeah. I mean, they were talking back then about markets being conversations. And, you know, and for me, that just stuck. And I was like, God, yeah, I think that. And it's so true. It's so true. And if you keep that thought in mind, particularly in this day and age, you know, that's really where we need to be focused.
I understand you have another book coming out. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I've just finished writing a book, which is a slightly different move for me, away from the tech side and the social technology side, towards more of the responsible marketing side. So it's a book around what we can all be doing as marketeers to be a little bit more sustainably focused.
When is it coming out?
It comes out in January 2021, published by Bloomsbury, and it is going to be called The Sustainable Marketeer, How to Drive Profits with Purpose. And so it's a book very close to my heart because, you know, it talks about the environment, it talks about what we're doing with the climate, packaging, and what really the role marketing has played over the years in this kind of overconsumption and what we can now be doing as marketeers to revisit that. And so because I interviewed a couple of people, really interested people in the book around certain topics. And one of them, he said to me, Michelle, have you read this book called The Uninhabitable Earth, The Story of the Future by David Wallace Wells? And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, read it because it's a redefining book. So that literally arrived from Amazon today. So it's on my desk and it's going to be my weekend read.
Well, that sounds like a good read. So at this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, such as the books you've mentioned, your website and your LinkedIn profile so listeners can connect with you. And thank you for joining us on the show. A word of advice, though, if you connect with Michelle, don't offer her social media training.
That's not going to go down well.
And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found right now by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Myths of Social Media: Dismiss the Misconceptions and Use Social Media Effectively in Business. The authors are Michelle Carville and Ian McCrae. Michelle, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, I would like to return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I will drop it in the mail to you. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on this show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.